Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro or Rebel Capitalist Live. I'm sure you saw the website there. It's rebelcapitalistlive.com. You get your tickets, incredible speakers, incredible networking event, really going to help you learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. So that was kind of my sales pitch there, in case you didn't hear it. All right, now let's get into your questions. Do you think it's too early to begin to dip into emerging markets? I fear the impact of the reduction. So let's just, don't ask me this question. Let's just think about what Jim Rogers would do. And he's my favorite investor. And I've had the opportunity to interview him several times, but you can read his books, you can read his interviews. The first one I ever read was in Market Wizards, and that had a massive impact on my thinking and my framework that I use as an investor. And so in my reading of Jim and listening to him in other interviews and having the opportunity to interview myself, I know that he doesn't just go in and buy an emerging market. That's not what Jim does. He will find something that he considers cheap for a specific reason, because it's very, very unloved. So an example would be Venezuela right now. Another example would be Turkey right now, because they're dealing with hyperinflations. Another example would be Russia, Ukraine, for obvious reasons. So these are the type of areas where, or markets where he likes to get involved. These are the markets where if you tell your friends or the average CNBC viewer, they'd tell you that you're absolutely out of your mind. You're crazy. That's good. So why is that good though? Most people don't understand. You make a lot more money when things go from horrible to bad than you do when things go from good to great. Let me say that one more time, because it's incredibly important. You make a lot more money, or your return is far, far greater when you're invested in a market where things go from horrible to bad than when you're invested in a market where things go from good to great. And this is something that Jim Rogers has done throughout his entire career. And he's got it right a heck of a lot more than he's got it wrong. But that said, Jim doesn't just go in because it's cheap. He doesn't go in just because it's unloved, like Turkey right now. He's not going into Turkey. He's not buying Russia. He's not buying Ukraine. He's not buying Venezuela. Why? Because although they might be cheap, there's no catalyst. You gotta have a catalyst, or else you're just trying to catch a falling knife. So what's the catalyst with Turkey? Well, I don't know. What's the catalyst with Venezuela? My guess would be when Maduro gets what's coming to him, or when they get him out and bring someone else in, and maybe they dollarize. That would be an example, and I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but I'm saying that would be an example of a big, big catalyst that, and again, the key here is you're looking for a catalyst that isn't necessarily going to take the country to great, but it's just going to take the country to bad. Because when you can get in when it's horrible and it goes to bad, you're getting a 100 bagger. When you get into a market that goes from good to great, you might double your money at the most, or maybe triple it at the absolute most. But you're not going to get a 100 bagger. And so what you do is, again, follow what Jim Rogers says. You do nothing. Just be patient and wait until a big pile of money is sitting in the corner, and then you go pick it up. Sounds simple. What does he mean by that? He means that get a watch list, put all of these markets on a watch list, or you know what I'm doing with commodities right now. Get it on a watch list, but don't feel like you just have to, you have to always be doing something. You always have to be buying or selling or do, no, you can go a year and do nothing, zero, because you don't see a great setup. You don't see something that's cheap. You don't, I mean, a lot of people, they say, you know, with real estate as an example, you guys know this. I always say, listen, it's in a bubble. That's obvious. Now, is the price going up or down? I don't know, but it's in a bubble. It's not cheap. I mean, You know, I was having lunch today and I was actually, I think I might have posted this on Twitter. So here you go. I had lunch this afternoon in Phoenix, and this was the billboard right outside of the place where I was having lunch. So this restaurant that has spicy food was advertising that their food is spicy by saying their food is hotter than the local real estate market. So these are not things that you see at a bottom. Like when I was buying all my real estate in 2012, you didn't see those billboards. You don't see those billboards when things are cheap. You see them when they're expensive. Now, it's not to say that housing prices can't double. Who knows how high they can go, but they're not cheap. And so people always hear me say that. They say, well, then what should I do? What if I can't buy real, you know, I got to do something. If real estate's not expensive, well, there's nothing else. Everything else is worse. So then I've just got to do real estate and just roll the dice and pray and keep my fingers crossed. No, you don't. You can do nothing. You can do zero, nada. You say, well, I've got a negative carry to inflation. Okay, you do. You do. But that's a negative carry with inflation, in my opinion, is better than blindly going in and buying an asset when it's expensive, hoping that it's just going to get more expensive. That's having a negative edge. And the more you do that, the higher the probability that you go bust. You have to have a positive edge. So, you know, if you're a real estate professional or something like that, or if you have an edge somehow like Kenny, well, great. That's a different matter. But so you see my point, right? So you're sitting here saying, I fear the impact of the reduction of the global supply of dollars, particularly if we enter a recession. Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree. But be very, very careful that you're not trying to answer a question of which direction is the price going to go. For me, like Jim Rogers says, that's a quick way to the poorhouse. So we don't, I believe, and you know, for what it's worth, that it's way better and you have a greater edge, or you have an edge, period, if you kind of try to abandon that type of thinking. And it's hard for most people, very hard, because that's really where they start. Is the price going to go up or down? Real estate, is the price going to go up or down? If the price is going to go up, well, then I want to buy it. If the price is going to go down, then I don't want to buy it. I think that's the worst way to look at investing. Simply ask, forget the price. Just ask yourself, is it cheap or is it expensive? Then if it's cheap, I'm not saying buy it, put it on a watch list. And then if you're dealing with countries, now sometimes with oil, I would say go ahead and buy it. But if you're dealing with these countries, put it on a watch list, wait for a catalyst. When there's a significant catalyst, then go in and make it happen. Real estate question. Should young couple looking for their first home continue renting for 1 to 2 years and look for a starter home soon in Texas? It's the same question. I would just simply ask you if the real estate in Texas right now is cheap or is it expensive? Just look at a historic chart adjusted for inflation. That's all you got to do. And the answer is going to be it's expensive. So I don't like buying anything that's not cheap. Well, what do I do? What do I do with my money? Well, wait till there's something that comes along that's cheap, and then you buy that. Now, there could be other reasons. You're a young couple, so maybe you're thinking about having kids, or maybe you have two or three kids, and you got a dog, and you know, all of these other reasons for buying a house are completely outside of the purview I'm referencing. That I'm not considering that. And obviously, and some people do and need to. I'm just talking, just looking at buying a house from a standpoint of a financial decision. And a financial decision alone, I would say, unless you've got an edge like Kenny, unless you're an expert in something, then it could be different. But if you're not an expert at something, or if you're not, you know, like if you were in your 80s and said, well, I just want a revenue stream. I'm just looking for an annuity and I'm not using any leverage. Okay, then maybe you want to buy a property in Texas because all you want is the $2,000 a month that it's throwing off in cash flow. A little bit different there, right? But if I was, and I can't give you personal investing advice because I don't know the rest of your situation, but if it were me and I was 25 years old, let's say, well, even me at 49 years old, it's still the same thing. It's just, if it's expensive, I don't buy it. And then if I want to live, I just rent. It's just, you know, sign a 2-year lease if you want the stability. But that's kind of how I answer that question, I guess. If the Fed does go through with issuance of central bank digital currency for central banks around the world, how do you think it would affect the euro dollar banking system? Would it become more transparent? No, I don't think it would become more transparent. How would it affect it? I don't know if the Fed would want to disrupt. This is a good question. I don't think the Fed would want to disrupt the current euro dollar system. I think they understand it, hopefully, more than they admit to. Hopefully, they realize that there's no way they could manage dollar liquidity at a global scale efficiently. And they would need those banks to do that for them. So I think, especially initially, that the Fed coin would be denominated in dollars, just like bank reserves. But let me back up. When XYZ Cayman Island Bank creates a dollar loan for Colombian corporation ABC, they don't need bank reserves to do that. They don't need to get the Fed's balance sheet involved, is what I'm saying. So they're effectively creating a reserveless, cashless system that is denominated in dollars. That's pretty much a central bank digital currency, with the exception of the fact that the CBDC, you would have an account with the Fed and everything would go through the Fed. So in a way, there's different, it's very hard to explain, but there's, you got to look at the dollar as separate currencies. Green pieces of paper aren't necessarily bank reserves. And bank reserves, although they're all denominated in dollars, they aren't necessarily dollars that are circulating the euro dollar system. Although there's a one-to-one relationship and they're all called dollars, right? So my point is, I think you would have really a Fed coin, it would still be dollars. It would still be dollars created by the euro dollar system that would be reserveless, wouldn't need bank reserves, wouldn't need to be get the Fed's balance sheet involved, but they'd set up the CBDC to get the local participants in the domestic economy running their transactions through the Fed. They could better manage dollar liquidity in the United States and then continue to have the euro dollar banks provide liquidity for those corporations internationally, and then they'd be interchangeable. So if you had dollars in a Swiss bank account, you could transfer those to the Fed, to your Fed account, and they would give you the dollars, but now all of a sudden those dollars turn into bank reserves. You see, so you start transacting with the local, and again, I need a whiteboard to explain this, but that's probably how I think they'd set it up initially. Now, I think gradually they would try to get more and more global participants to interact directly with the Fed for their dollar liquidity needs instead of going to Cayman Island Bank XYZ, because the Fed can undercut them as far as interest rate. Because remember, the Fed doesn't necessarily have to be paid back. Cayman Island Bank wants to be paid back. They've got a P&L. They can't have negative equity. And they could, but it's the central bank can have negative equity a lot easier. So if the Fed wants more market share, they can come in and say, okay, if the going rate for this huge corporate loan is 4%, we'll give it to you at 3.5. And our underwriting will be much looser. So I'm not sure if I'm really specifically answering your question, but I don't think much changes initially. I think they roll into that Fed coin with a domestic rollout first via UBI and kind of the average Joe and Jane downloading the Fed app onto their phone. And then businesses in the United States also having an account with the Fed. So all those transactions can go through the central bank. But I don't think that when they roll this out, they would say, okay, we're just going to somehow force everyone to go through the Fed, because that would you want to talk about implode the global economy. Holy cow. Obviously, they don't know as much as Snyder, not even close. I mean, Snyder's forgotten more about the system, the global monetary system, than the people at the Fed know. But I do believe they know enough to realize that that you want to make that transition very, very, very slowly. You're playing with fire right there. And even if they want to usurp power, control, and wealth, which I believe they do, they realize that they don't want to, they want to take control of a system that is currently in place. They don't want to destroy the whole thing to where we're living in caves just so they can say that they're king of the cave. They want to be king of the world as is, right? You see what I'm saying? It's just like, I won't go off on another tangent, but so hopefully that makes sense. First, let me just reiterate to make sure we're on the same page. First, I think they roll out a Fed coin for the average Joe and Jane Americans. You download the app, you get your UBI. Fed coins, bank reserves denominated in dollars, just like JP Morgan, most of the dollars on their balance sheet, asset side, are liabilities of the Fed, i.e. bank reserves. Then they gradually transition to all these corporations outside of the United States and sovereigns that maybe they don't have accounts with the Fed, swap lines, something like that, where they now have an account with the Fed and they can source their dollar liquidity needs directly from Jerome Powell instead of having to go to XYZ Cayman Island Bank, right? But that's a slow transition. So that's kind of the progression that would make the most sense to me. Where would you stash a life insurance policy? Banker? Oh, I don't know. I don't have a life insurance policy. So I don't know. I'm not sure how those work, Mike. I apologize. I've got a trust set up. So if I get hit by a bus or something like that, my assets aren't actually distributed. The liquid assets I have, but the real estate assets, they stay in the trust, and the cash flow from the assets just go to my family to make sure my family's taken care of. But my family's taken care of with the cash flow. They're not taken care of by, you know, if I get hit by a bus, my mom gets, you know, these houses, and my sister gets this, and my brother gets this, and then they can do what they want to with it. That's not the way I set it up. I set it up so nobody gets anything other than the cash flow that's being thrown off by the trust itself. And I did that intentionally. So, because I want to make sure they're taken care of. And I thought that would be the best way to do it. Instead of give them the asset, give them the cash flow from the asset. How bad do you think the world food shortage gets? Impact on poor countries, impact on US. So I think poor countries will see where they just don't have food or very little. US, I think just prices go up. The reason being, and I was going to do, I think I'm getting my whiteboard videos mixed up. No, I think it is the global elite one that I did last week, but because I've done another one that for Tuesday already. That's why I'm getting them mixed up. But we got to realize that the commodities are settled in dollars, and the US is therefore is the only country that can print the currency needed to buy the stuff, the food, the energy. No other country can do that. None. The only way they can get dollars to buy the stuff they need, the stuff settled in dollars, is to earn it or borrow it. And then you get the euro dollar system involved. Those banks creating dollars, they can create dollars to give the countries the dollar liquidity. But if the banks don't see them as a good risk reward, then they're not getting the money. Now look at Turkey. This is the problem there. This is one of the problems with Sri Lanka. They say, well, they don't have any energy. Well, what they have, they're going through hyperinflation. Why? Why? Because they don't have enough dollars. They didn't earn enough dollars to buy the energy they need. Therefore, in the case of Turkey, they had to start printing Turkish lira to buy the dollars to buy the energy. You see, if they would have had the dollar cash flow coming in to begin with, they wouldn't have had a problem. Now, I'm sure there's multiple variables, but that's the main thing that's causing problems for them, where the United States would never be in that position because we wouldn't have to print dollars to buy yuan, or maybe we will in the future. But right now, we don't have to print dollars to buy yuan or rubles to settle for the stuff, all the consumer goods, let's say, that we have coming in that fill the shelves of Walmart, Home Depot, and Target. So this puts the United States in a very enviable position where I don't think, now there's going to be less stuff for sure, But I don't think people are going to be starving and just they can't find food anywhere at any price, because at the end of the day, I think the government will just give everyone food stimmies. And then because the government is giving food stimmies, then we can bid a lot higher for those scarce resources. And those scarce resources, i.e. food, will go to the highest bidder. And because we have the reserve currency, because we can print the currency to trade for those commodities, then we will be the highest bidder. It's a effed up system. I mean, it's horribly unfair. It's ridiculous, really, that the United States has this advantage to where everyone else has to work. Everyone else has to produce to consume. And we don't. We don't. But it is what it is. And unfortunately, we're going to have to pay the price in the long run. But for right now, going into 2022, the best place to be for a food shortage, assuming that you can't just grow the food locally, like in Colombia. But the best, if you are in a country, or if you had to choose between countries that are dependent on other countries for certain food sources or energy sources, you want to be in the United States. Because it is the only country that can print the currency used to settle those transactions. Now that could be changing, but right now that's the way the world works. And again, impact on poor countries, it really depends, Peter, on which poor country, like and where, you know. Again, Colombia, I don't know if you'd consider that a poor country. Maybe now you might not consider that a poor country. Maybe you're like an emerging market or something. But I mean, if you're in Medellin, I can't imagine they're going to have a problem with food. I mean, they grow everything like within 10 miles, just an insane amount of food. The only way they would have a problem with food is if the government did something to screw everything up, like a hyperinflation deal. I mean, they could. They're trying to elect some knucklehead down there that was good buddies with Chavez in Maduro. You would hope that he's smart enough to learn from their mistakes, but you never know. I know a lot of my friends in Colombia are very, very, very worried right now. And that just goes to show you that, and I had this conversation with Doug Casey the other day. Now's not a good time to figure out where you're going to live for the next 10 years. Not a good time to do that. I think now what you want to do is where would I like to spend some time for the next 3 months, maybe the next 6 months, and then reevaluate when we get there. Because the world is just changing too quickly. We have no idea what any country is going to look like in 6 months, let alone in 6 years or 10 years or something like that. So like Doug says, you just got to be a tourist right now. Just make sure that you're a tourist, because no matter how bad a country is going to get, if you're just there for 3 months as a tourist right now, it's not really going to affect you too much. But what you don't want to do is behave, like Doug says, as a vegetable, where you just go somewhere and you pretend that you're growing roots and you can just never leave. Like once you make a decision, that's it. You're there hell or high water for the next 10 years. I don't think that's a good strategy right now at all. I've been calling that on my videos, the Hotel California Plan B. And so many people get into that mode where they try to set up a plan B. It's like the Hotel California, where you go somewhere and you can never leave. And so they got to have this check, this box check, that box check, that box. And unfortunately, right now, every country sucks. Every government sucks. There is no good government right now in the world. They're all Marxists. They're all socialists. They're all horrible. Name a place. Russia, they're terrible. Ukraine, United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the EU, China. Where? Show me a place with even a decent government. No, they're all Marxists. I mean, I'm using that term broadly, but they're all authoritarians and they're all central planners. So again, I wish it was different, but that's the world we live in right now. And so that's why I would suggest, and I know it sucks. I know it's not ideal. I know it's suboptimal. I get it. But I think that's the best bad option we have. Just plan 3-6 months ahead, and that's all you can do, and then reevaluate. Has Russia truly put a floor under the price of gold at 1850? Or do you still think the price? No, they haven't put a floor on it. In a market, what you had to do, Bob, is go back and look at a chart of the price of gold during 2008 when Lehman blew up. I believe it did the same thing with Bear Stearns. Definitely when Lehman. And then look at a chart of gold price during the Cerveza sickness in 2020, March. You can see it tanks. And it's always going to do that because in a crisis situation, when everything is tanking, you can't get a bid. If you're one of these huge money managers with a massive pool of money, you have to come up with liquidity. You have to come up with dollars. And what can you sell? There's not a bid for anything. Well, there's always going to be a bid for gold. It's going to be a much lower price. But if that's the only thing in your portfolio that you can sell, and you have to sell something, you got to sell gold. So if we get a big market crash, and I'm not saying that we will, maybe the Fed can just continue with what they've been doing, and that's just trying to talk the market down. So it kind of, we go into this bear market gradually and slowly in an orderly fashion. And then you might not see gold sell off too much, but if we get another Cerveza sickness move, which is possible, then you're going to see gold really sell off, regardless of what Russia is doing. And unless they started explicitly, you know, settling their oil or nat gas for gold itself at a specific price to create that arbitrage, then they'd be setting a theoretical floor. But I haven't seen them do that. I've seen Grohman talk about it, you know, a lot, Luke Grohman. But I haven't heard, obviously they're pricing stuff in rubles, but I haven't heard them talk about pricing stuff in gold at a set price or at a set rate, I guess is maybe a better way to say it. So in other words, saying we're going to sell oil for, you know, 100 barrels for 1 ounce of gold, something like that. So, and that's a peg. That would set up a floor, most likely. But without them doing that, I don't see anything that they're currently doing preventing gold from going under 1850, especially if we have a blow up in the stock market and all these big funds have to sell whatever they can sell on their balance sheet.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
When we had the gold standard, what was the interaction between the gold, USD peg, and fractional reserve banking? Wouldn't banks create money, distort the peg? No, because you just had, so the peg was for the central bank. So the individual, so you could go to the central bank with an ounce of gold, or excuse me, with, what was it, $35 or something, and they would give you your ounce of gold, because that's the commercial banks held their gold at the Fed. And so the commercial banks could go ahead and issue currency, but with that, which were IOUs for gold. And then if you got those IOUs for gold, they were redeemable at the central bank. But that didn't really restrict M2 money supply. That was really I don't know if you'd call it a soft peg, but that was kind of the way it worked. And that was supposed to limit the supply of dollars created, because if too many dollars were created, then what would happen is people would get worried, they'd start redeeming, that would reduce the amount of gold, and therefore that would most likely reduce the ability to continue to create money, and you'd reduce the money supply. And that's kind of how we got to the situation where we were in 1971, where they had to depeg. But technically you could lever up to the point. See, I don't know how they'd measure M2. It was really just a peg with the central bank. And just the reason you got the peg broken is because too many people wanted their gold back instead of these dollars that were being created. And a lot of that was due to the euro dollar system, because there were so many dollars that were being created outside of the United States, and those dollars flood back in and they want gold. And there's just simply not enough gold to go around, because there were so many dollars being created outside of the United States in the euro dollar system. Now, so to your point, they really, if it was just domestic, there should have been an equalizing mechanism there, where because the so let me go back to the beginning, and maybe this is easier to understand. What would happen is people would deposit their gold with the bank, and then the bank, this is free banking, and then what the bank would do is they would go ahead and say, okay, well, we'll issue these IOUs, that was debt, and they're redeemable for the gold that you have here, and we can issue, let's say, a 10-to-1 ratio, and everyone's still going to have the confidence, because if they want their gold, there's 10% of it there. And so that's where we're in our comfort zone. And based on that balance sheet, we won't have people doing a bank run, and we're good to go. And so we're just going to make sure that we're lending productively to make sure we're getting paid back and everyone is happy. And then when the central bank comes in, then they say, okay, banks, well, now what we're going to do is we're going to take all the gold that you have for your customers, and then we're just going to give you bank reserves, and that's going to be the asset that you hold on file. And then if someone wants their gold, then it's still redeemable, but instead of going through the commercial bank, now you got to go through the central bank. And we're just going to go ahead and theoretically, make sure that there's enough gold reserve, bank reserves. And at a 10-to-1 ratio, we're going to kind of use that to make sure that there's not too many dollars floating around the system for the specific amount of gold that we have at the Federal Reserve. But you can see the flaws in that, right? And you can see why the idea is good, but in practice, it really doesn't work. And that's why it's kind of surprising that the gold standard actually lasted as long as it did, because it's kind of just a system that was pieced together with kind of spit and duct tape, and more so based on faith. And that's probably why the transition away from the gold standard in 71 wasn't that big of a deal, because there really wasn't anything built on that to begin with, other than the perception of the general public. You're pretty much right on. It didn't really affect the peg, because you didn't have people, redeeming it, but it still allowed the commercial banks and the commercial banks outside the United States in the euro dollar system to create as many dollars as they wanted to create. Really wasn't anything constraining them, other than in the United States, technically, they had to have a 10% reserve requirement, but there were so many ways around that, again, people like to think that was a big deal and that constrained the banks, but it didn't. It absolutely didn't. They could still lend as much as they wanted to lend. So I'm just scrolling down. Here's another Bitcoin scam, just from some scammer that uses my name and face here, guys. Just FYI. I know I addressed this in the last stream because I saw one of these. Whenever you see someone using my name and my face and they're talking about Bitcoin or crypto or WhatsApp, this person or that person, it is an absolute scam and completely disregarded. And I apologize. I can assure you that my team does everything they can to reduce the number of these posts and delete them, but there's too many of them. They just completely overwhelm us. And so the best thing that I can do is just bring this to your attention and just spread the word, you know, to your friends that watch the channel. Never, ever, 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 ever click on one of these George Gammon impersonators that's trying to get you to call a WhatsApp number or anything with crypto or, you know, any fund manager that, you know, saying that they, you know, with all my videos, it's all, on every single comment, it'll be some scammer using my name and profile and saying, oh, text me, I've got a great opportunity for you. You know, Mr. Bigglesworth or whatever is an incredible investment advisor. Yeah, it's always just, I can't believe people fall for this. But obviously they do, or the scammers wouldn't do it. So just beware, just never, ever answer one of those. How are banks loaning people money for these inflated homes, properties, and other items like vehicles? What's leverage? Well, the banks are loaning money for these things because the banks aren't holding the loans on their balance sheet. So the bank is just an intermediary. So they're selling that loan before the paint's dry, or before the ink's dry, rather. So if you've got the Fed buying these loans and they don't have to worry about having negative equity or P&L or the balance sheet, the underwriting just be like, hey, whatever, who cares? We don't care if they're going to pay back the loan. It's on the Fed's balance sheet, not on our balance sheet. The taxpayer is going to pay for it. So how banks are lending is they're lending and not caring about who they're lending to, because they're just flipping the loan to Fannie and Freddie and they're just packaging it, you know, the mortgage-backed sausages. And then the Fed's just buying it. Now, they've brought QE down to zero. So now they're not. So this is why, Amanda, you see the delta, or you see the 30-year fixed rate mortgage scream higher. You see the 30-year fixed rate mortgage has gone up by 2.5%, where Fed funds has only gone up by 75 basis points. Why? Because the Fed's no longer buying. And if those mortgages through mortgage-backed securities are now being absorbed by the private sector, they're going to demand a risk premium for future inflation expectations. So if they're demanding a risk premium that the Fed wasn't demanding, they're not going to pay the same price. They're going to pay a lower price. And if they pay a lower price, because there's an inverse relationship between the price and the interest rate, that means price go down, interest rate go up. And so I think the question you really have to ask yourself is, if the Fed does quantitative tightening, the opposite of QE, where they start selling mortgage-backed securities back into the market, what's that going to do to interest rates? Or what's that going to do to mortgage rates? Because now you're flooding the market with more supply of mortgages. More supply means price goes down, which means when mortgages are originated now or in the future, they are going to have to compete with the existing price, or the existing price of the supply. So if the existing price of the supply is going down because Fed is creating more supply by selling the mortgage-backed securities on their balance sheet, that means interest rates going up. That means the interest rates for the new loans that are being originated will have to go up to meet that level. So yeah, this is the whiteboard. In fact, I'm looking at it right here. This is the whiteboard that it's going to be live on Tuesday, where I go through this process where I say that, you know, if the Fed, let's say they want to unload the mortgages, if they just do that, and then even they do QE again, if they're not buying the mortgages, if that's having to be absorbed by the private sector, even if they're lowering rates, you could see mortgage rates go up while Fed funds goes down. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it could. My whole point there is, when you're looking at, you know, how can banks be lending right now? I would never lend money. You know, we're going to recession. We've got the inversion of the yield curve. We've got negative GDP growth, Q1 at 1.5% in real terms. We've got all these things. We've got Russia, Ukraine. We've got China. You've got all the, why on earth would a bank lend money? Because again, they lend it, and as soon as they get that loan, they sell it to Fannie, Freddie, or to whomever, and it's no longer on their balance sheet, and they basically just collect a fee for it. So they're more like a loan originator. They're really not like a lender anymore. But that could change if the Fed starts doing quantitative tightening. And it's changed significantly since they stopped doing QE. So that means that you're going to most likely, until the Fed breaks something and has to reverse course, you're most likely going to see interest rates across the board, not just with mortgages, but with credit card, with auto loans, with everything. You're going to most likely see interest rates go up, because all those other interest rates would have to compete with mortgages. So it's like all the boats in the harbor rise and fall with the tide. Same thing with interest rates. Why does Snyder not believe in hard money? It's not that he doesn't believe in it. It's that it's suboptimal. Because if there's a fixed supply of money, if money is inelastic, it would hamper growth. Long term, there's an argument why it might not, because it would also significantly reduce the boom and bust cycle. But over the short and midterm, see what happens is, let's just imagine there was $1 in the whole world. And what most people would say is, oh, George, well, that's not a problem, because the dollar would get turned into, you know, subdivided from there and subdivided and subdivided and subdivided and subdivided. And then you would have enough currency units. It's just it wouldn't be in dollars. It would be some fraction of a dollar. You can think of Bitcoin and Satoshis as an example. But what they don't realize is, to transition to that system where there's a fixed money supply, prices have to come down. Okay, well, how do prices come down? They don't come down magically. They come down through the production of supply, through the production of goods and services. You have to have more supply of stuff. Well, how do you get the more supply of stuff without the capital? See, the way you get the capital is by lending more money into existence, by having an elastic money supply. This is what the a lot of the Bitcoin maximalists, and even some of the sound money. And I'm a sound money guy, but I don't think there should be a set amount of money. And the only way to create more currency is just to subdivide the existing amount of money that's available to the globe. That is, again, you're really going to reduce the boom and bust cycle. That's the pro. But the con is, you are going to massively limit growth, because in order for more projects to be funded, it's going to have to come straight out of savings, which that's going to be a lot fewer projects funded. And it's going to mean you're going to have to wait until the prices come down in order to fund those projects to where the existing amount of currency can be subdivided. But this is a paradox, because how are you going to get those prices to come down if there isn't capital for the new projects to create the supply necessary to bring the prices down in the first place? And I haven't really talked to anyone in the space that really pounds the table for sound money who has addressed that paradox. Obviously Snyder has. So again, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I don't think he's against sound money. He would say that it's suboptimal, and he's absolutely right. Absolutely right. You just have to kind of pick your poison. Do you want an inelastic money supply, and do you want to limit growth but reduce boom bust cycle? Or do you want to have an elastic money supply and maximize short and midterm growth, but then create a bigger boom bust cycle? The where I always land on this is, I think the best is a hybrid system. It's by no means perfect, but we're imperfect humans living in an imperfect world. So we can't expect to have perfect money, because it's always going to be controlled by us and we're imperfect. So the best system, I think, is just free banking. And that's where the government is not involved. You do not have a central bank. The market sets interest rates, and the banks issue their own currencies. And they can create fractional reserve. That's fine. But since there's no one bailing them out, then they are incentivized to lend productively. They're incentivized to lend to entities who are going to use those additional currency units to create more goods and services. Therefore, naturally, you're going to have deflation, which is exactly what we saw in the 1800s when we had free banking. And most people don't realize that we had natural deflation in the 1800s with fractional reserve banking. But we had all the liability go back to the banks and the shareholders of the bank. And therefore, again, there's a huge difference when the banks are incentivized to lend productively and lend for consumption. Right now, all of our banks, the only thing they do is just lend for consumption or asset prices or a financialization of the economy. They don't really lend anymore to produce stuff. And that's one of the reasons why our economy is so fragile. All right, guys, I've got to get over to the live stream for Rebel Capitals Pro. Let me do some shout outs here. We've got Bob the Builder, High Tones Drifter, Kent, Ukbay Nguyen, LA's, Robert Hines, Lord Gruzak, Bull Dag, Dapper Dave 2021, Armchair, somebody, where'd Armchair go? Armchair Contrarian, Douglas PC, Lord Parker, my good buddy Market Mania Canada. Guys, you got to check out his YouTube channel. He's creating some fantastic content. The last time I checked it out, we got Wayne Smith, All Nighter Hider in the house, Peyton G, RR, Michael Gray, Deeps, Alan Zibelman, Booze Bay, Malaysia, Numismatic, Sherry, St. Louis the Fourth, I believe. I never really knew how those numerals work, but I think that's four, right? Josh Calabe, Supernatural. Oh, come on. All righty, guys. Enjoy the rest of your evening. And make sure you check out Rebel Capitalist Live at rebelcapitalistlive.com. You got to get your tickets. Can't wait to see you in Miami, June 24th through the 26th. And I look forward to seeing you guys in the next video. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.